The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bizzle Fuma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids. You know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Hey, listen.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another One Upsmanship. Oh, boy, it's been a while. It feels like it's been a while.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm Michael Swaim. Who's that with me?
That's me, Adam Ganser, co-host.
And it feels like it's been too long, right?
Oh,
maybe
it
a
does.
Week extra,
yeah.
Week longer than, I don't know how the cycle got messed up, but it feels like it's been too long and too long since we had our very special guest with us. Welcome,
hey.
Mr. Zach Ryan.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for coming back.
Yeah, it's been since
Ghost
of Tsushima, I think.
Yep.
Ghost of Tsushima, yeah. Great game. Mm-hmm. Still your game? Was that your game of the year?
So I did love Ghost of Tsushima, but I think at the end of the year, Hades ended up kind of winning out for me.
Wow.
Just because, yeah, I really loved Ghost of Tsushima, but man, I got into Hades in an unhealthy way. I played just an insane amount of that game. So,
yeah, I ended up logging 250 in that game, which if for me is very hefty. That's longer than I usually spend with one game. What were you going to say?
I was going to ask, is there a point where it stops sort of yielding new story returns? Like, when is it just for fun and not any new?
I don't think that I've played... I don't think that I played 250 hours. I know that I played a lot, and I completed it several times and still didn't get all of the story stuff. And, you know, there's all the relationships to max out, and those yield more story things. And like, there are definitely some relationships in that game that I didn't max out, but I loved it enough that I played such a significant amount of time on Switch. And then when I saw that it was coming to Xbox Game Pass, I was like, hell, I'll do it all again there too, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. I also did not reach the end of the story or, you know, the story threads to the point that I sat there wondering an impossibly stupid thing to wonder, like, are there infinite procedurally generated stories? But it's like, no, it's voice actors. It can't be infinite, but it really is phenomenally deep. And I'm going to get us on track, but I think that segues nicely because we're talking about another phenomenally deep game that features a repetitious cycle that is very brutal, much like Hades, especially when you start out. Because we're talking about Bloodborne. Woo! I think people have been waiting for this one for a long time.
I have been waiting for this one.
I know some. Folks who have.
I've been waiting for this.
Really?
This is one when we first talked about this podcast. We were like, we got to cover Bloodborne, right? And we're finally ready to do it.
We're just over 3 years into the life of this podcast, for reference.
Yeah.
So that's comforting actually, because you know, video games take so much longer than movies. I always worry that, like, how many games have I played in my life? When will we run out of games that I've played? But not yet is the answer. There's still a ton of shit that we're like, I can't believe we haven't covered that yet. And one of them is from Software's Bloodborne, from, of course, also brought us Sekiro Shadows Die Twice, and then the progenitor to Bloodborne, the Dark Souls games. And we talk to a lot of layman listeners here. We cater to them. So we'll just say that if you don't know, From Software, the maker of Bloodborne, have become synonymous with this genre of games. That's how impactful this game is.
Yeah.
Everyone fucking loves it, and we'll dig a lot into that and the culture around it. And probably a little game called Elden Ring that's on the horizon from Software. But before we do, let's get into format and put Zach right on the spot for the speed run. Do you remember that from last time, Zach? You know the rules?
Mm-hmm.
All right. He's ready to go.
Okay, give me a refresher prepared. Just in case.
It's just an elevator pitch / logline, like how you'd recap the game to someone you ran into on a street corner and you're in a hurry, but you want them to get the gist, and they know nothing about Bloodborne. They never heard of it.
Right. Okay. So
yeah?
Bloodborne is a gothic Victorian horror RPG from Software. The key tenements are... extreme challenge and exploration being rewarded through that challenge. I think that's probably the summary that I would go with.
Okay.
Stop the clock. The clock was self-starting that time. We'll still insert it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You definitely saved Sonic from drowning because that was quick. It didn't... I don't know that you could, though. Gothic is a good catch-all word, but I think we'll have to dig into, like, the vibe, because the vibe's very, very specific.
Yeah.
So let's get a little more into our various points of view by passing a checkpoint, which I guess means we all died.
That's
the most prevalent form of checkpoint.
We went to the dreaming, right? We went to the hunter's dream.
That's right.
Spent a couple of blood vials to buy some blood orbs and then a couple of blood echoes. To upgrade our blood-based weapon, and then went back to the same damn place.
I pushed through a wall of mist and was immediately decapitated. Just immediately dead. But it's time for rants.
Yeah.
And we do the old rant sandwich here, which means hosts on the outside, guest in the middle.
Sure.
Adam, you want to rant first?
Yeah, sure. I'll do it.
All right. Player one.
Player one, Adam Ganser logging in. Okay, so From Software Games... have always been frustrating to me in a way that was not fun. But something about Bloodborne from the first time I played it until the time I played it where I actually beat it, like it just had a little more allure to it. I don't know why. I've been thinking about it for like maybe 4 or 5 months since I beat it. I think the answer is that it's a lot more action feeling than, say, like a Dark Souls game, which is more sort of block-based. I think also you said the vibe. The vibe is totally the best thing about this game. Like it just feels really creepy, but not in like a jump scare way. Just in like a just sort of a gross, like decaying, morbid, playful way almost. I enjoyed every single boss fight that I did after the blood-starved beast. Cause fuck that blood-starved beast. Like that guy's a fucking bastard. Basically, like, I felt this game, like, once you kind of got your feet under you, it became very enjoyable, and once you leveled up enough so that you weren't getting your ass kicked every time, then it really felt like just sort of playing a ritualistic puzzle that was very rewarding, and you get into the right headspace, and once you get there, this game is one of the best games you'll ever play in this genre. Or maybe period. Like if somebody was like, this is in the top 10 games of all time, I'd think that was a lot. Mm-hmm. But top 50, I wouldn't be that offended by that because I think it's a really creative, interesting game. I think the fact that there's no blocking is like sort of subtly really important. Like the fact that you don't block, but that you have to sort of jump in and out and like earn back your health if you lose it, makes it a more action-y feeling experience. Which I think is like the secret sauce to me that just got me hooked on this. The story is absurd and impossible. And I don't mean impossible like how can a story be this? I mean it isn't a story because I watched a 30-minute video of a person who dared to explain it and like tie all the loose threads together. And I still don't believe it's a story. which to me is fine because I don't really think the story in this game is a heightening thing. But I do feel like From Software could afford to, like, let us understand what we're doing. I think From Software could afford that. Like, they could make a move that's like, here's kind of what's really going on, and the games wouldn't suffer for that. I don't think it needs to be as obtuse as it is. I enjoyed this tremendously. I think it's a great streaming game. Like, if you're a person who watches streams or does streams and you want to play this game, this is a really good one because people will get excited when you win. Like, it's a very triumphant feeling when you beat a boss, and that's a really unique experience in video games now. You know, like, there's just not a lot like that. So I loved it, and that's my rant.
As usual, your rant, very triggering for me. Hard not to interrupt. Tons of stuff I want to say. But it's not my time. It's Player 2's time. And today, Zach, you are Player 2. What is the core of your emotional experience with Bloodborne?
I also heard a lot of things that I wanted to respond to in that rant and in Adam's rant. And I think that not in a way that's like, hey, you got these things wrong, but in a way of like, yes, absolutely correct. Like that, those are the things that I love about Bloodborne. First of all, to me, this is probably a top 10 game of all time for me. I played this game many times in different sorts of settings. Most recently, I replayed it with my girlfriend who had never finished it before, and she and I played our way through it, and that was really phenomenal. You know, you talked about how it's like an incredible streaming game because you celebrate the kind of triumphs together and like, watching her overcome these bosses, and not that I'm like a coach or anything, because I'm still, despite having played it probably 6 or 7 times, I'm still not very good at it. But like watching her make her way through these bosses and stuff was like really super fun. This game in particular holds a very special place in my heart, not only because I think that it is legitimately one of the best games ever made, but also because my first month at IGN when I got hired in 2015, they put me on a plane to go to Japan and interview a bunch of the developers for Bloodborne before I knew what a Souls game was. And the two folks
must
have
been nice, you pre-pandemic motherfucker.
Yeah, and like sorry, Swaim. We've had very different experiences. But you know, the two guys that I went on that trip with were like huge Dark Souls fans and like couldn't wait to see this thing. And I got my hands on it when we were playing it for preview, on this IGN first trip, and I fucking hated it. I just couldn't understand why anybody would want to throw themselves against the cleric beast 15, 20, 30 times before, moving on to the next thing. And it wasn't until, I played this game. I got a copy when it came out because I was like, this is my first big thing. I'm so excited to be in the industry, play this game that I saw the work behind the scenes on. And like, I got two or three, in fact, I think I got to the Bloodstar Beast and hung it up and was like, this game is too hard. It's not fun. And when it came to, Game of the Year conversations in November, December of that year, everyone at IGN was like, well, not everyone, but a lot of people were championing Bloodborne. Like, hey, this game is phenomenal. It does something that, it takes the Dark Souls formula and makes it something that is more accessible and also somehow equally obtuse. And so I went back and started playing through it again, and that is when I really understood what the gameplay loop was and got, like, I think it's one of the most satisfying gameplay loops in any game ever made. Like, I think the ability to go in, understand the layout of an area, and, just smash through a bunch of enemies, collect a bunch of points, and go back and upgrade so that you can go through the next areas and understand them a little bit better. I think that that's really incredible. I have always been a very dedicated Castlevania fan since the first time I played Symphony of the Night, and then went back and played some of the older Castlevania games. And I have always thought of this, in the way that people often compare the original Dark Souls to Zelda, like, oh, Dark Souls is just like Zelda was when it first came out. Like, Bloodborne is to Castlevania what Dark Souls is to Zelda. I think that this is probably the best Castlevania game made since Konami stopped making Castlevania games. And I think you're absolutely spot on with the way that it rewards the player for that sort of risk-reward gameplay. Souls is very sword and board, and it's very play cautiously. Make sure you understand the patterns and get in an attack when you can. But Bloodborne really encourages you to take some risks. And, once you master the stun in this game, like once you can get that rifle counter down, holy shit, there are very, very few things in gaming that feel as satisfying as getting those critical hits in like that. Maybe the Makiri counter in Sekiro, but this game in particular changed the way that I thought about and played video games, and made me seek out challenging games in a way that I hadn't before. Like, once I was able to complete Bloodborne, it opened me up to all, you know, obviously all the Dark Souls games, but also all these other games that I always thought were like, ah, that's just too hard. I don't want to throw myself against that, you know, and like, that has been something that I've really relished in. Like, I play a lot of games on easy just to get through them, but the Souls games I come to specifically knowing that I'm just going to get the shit kicked out of me and I'm here for it. And like, Bloodborne, I think, is the best one at that. And that's the end of my rant.
Loved it.
Wow.
Bloodborne.
Profound.
Bloodborne is a gateway drug. Zach 100%. Ryan loved it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that you brought up both Metroid and Castlevania, mm-hmm. a player three logging on, ranting at you, because I think that that is the other genre that enshrines and does honor to the massive, brutal, punishing, almost too frustrating to complete boss fight that you ultimately get, and then just like dopamine floods your body in a rush. Mm-hmm. And, I'll say, at first I was unhappy to be here today, not because of the wonderful company I get to share, but because I hate that there's this culture around Bloodborne. Okay, so I'm the guy for whom, now I'm glad I'm here because someone should represent this perspective, but I'm the guy for whom that moment still hasn't come. It's like jazz, you see. Yeah. I understand and appreciate and can see that it's good and don't argue when other people say it's good, but I don't get it. It still just seems like a frustration machine. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, I guess it's good that I'm here, because I don't think my experience is wholly unique. It might be the minority experience, but I don't think I'm the only one who plays through Bloodborne and it's like, the vibe is so awesome. Mm-hmm. But it makes me feel dumb. Like, I literally can't understand the stats board because it's too massive and extensive and cryptic regarding what the items actually do and affect and what stats affect what. I'm not a big gambler. And I do think there is a sort of metaphysical relationship between the same kind of impulse that makes you value the fluctuations in chance and luck enough to sit at a slot machine or, a roulette wheel. I think there's that same kind of rush with the system that From Software basically invented, which is banking your progress. Just for people who haven't played any games like this, it's banking your progress at certain points. So there's a lot of tension as you're navigating, because if you die, you get reset a significant amount. Mm-hmm. And making sure that your knowledge basically is the only way, like your knowledge of the way the enemies move is actually what allows you to progress further through this world map, essentially. And unlike most games we cover on this podcast, I think I've only gotten to the second or third boss. I've definitely only explored one area of this game, and I have put a good 50 to 60 hours into this game.
Whoa.
And I just never got that past sucks. Those points. And it does hurt, because it feels like they made a toy to be like, you don't get to play with this toy. And when you tell other gamers about this, they go, oh, I guess you're old and bad at games now. That's interesting to know. Like, there is a toxic fan base around Bloodborne and From Software games in general that reminds me of the fact that back in when I first engaged with video games in the arcade, there were high stakes because I was losing real money. Mm. And if I failed, I couldn't play anymore because there were people in line behind me. From Software feels like they want to bring that back. And I was glad that we ascended over that and weren't doing that anymore. Like, I don't play games to experience an extreme amount of pressure and frustration, only to feel the rush of relief when that frustration is finally gone. Mm-hmm. It seems counterproductive to me. I don't get it. I'm really upset that I just admitted that I don't understand jazz, because that's way more damning. And that's my rant.
I don't think
Live Nation presents Concert Week.
Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of seven kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
I don't think you're wrong. I don't think that you're wrong. You know, I do think that there is this collective conversation around From Soft Games, you know, and the obviously the internet meme is that you have to get good. Right?
Yeah, get, like, good. Oh,
get good. Yep. Right? Just get good.
And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword because, honestly, that is the only way that you can get through these games. You have to understand the language that the games are trying to teach you in order to get through these games. And it does take a fair amount of dedication and practice. Like, I've never really been like a huge character action guy, you know, like Bayonetta, Devil May Cry, like Ninja Gaiden. Like, I've played these games casually in a way that it's like, oh, I'll check them out. And some of them I like and some of them I don't. And I play them by button mashing my way through them. And at the end, if I have roll credits, you know, it's like, okay, great. I kind of faked my way through this. That's not a possibility in these games. Like, you have to understand where your iframes are, and you have to understand what the hitboxes of the bosses look like, and you have to understand the positioning of your character versus, the enemies that you're fighting, and you have to exercise the patience needed to get through these areas because, like, every time you enter a new area, you just have to accept the fact that, like, okay, well, the next 2 hours is going to suck. Like, the next 2 hours is not going to be super fun while I'm learning where these enemies are hiding and, you know, the magnitude of just how unprepared I am for these enemies in these new areas. Like, it's all kind of part of the rich tapestry that From Software games weave.
Of your failure,
but there is no way around it. You know, like, I would argue that, like, Sekiro is probably the game that is the worst at this because, or the best, I guess, like, depending on where you're looking at it, because... Uh-huh.
This moment of appreciation finally came for me during Sekiro, which is the follow-up to Bloodborne, because it allows, there was a second conduit that you could get good at. I got good at the stealth element rather than getting good at combat, and I enjoyed that option was there.
That's interesting because, like, I was really frustrated with Sekiro because when I had problems with a boss in Bloodborne or Dark Souls or Dark Souls 2 or 3 or whatever, I would just go and grind. I would just go back to an area that I knew and fight bosses in a pattern or fight enemies in a pattern that I knew and, you know, get a few more points attributed to damage or defense or whatever. Mm. But Sekiro doesn't really allow you to do that. You just have to understand the sword play in that game. So I think it's the harder of the FromSoft games. But Bloodborne is, you know, unique in the way that at least Bloodborne lets you get back some of the damage that you incur if you're quick enough.
Yeah,
you know, like, if you get hit by a boss, you can make up some of that damage by getting in and getting a few hits off and edging a little bit of your health back. And that is a little more forgiving than Dark Souls or Sekiro, where like once you get hit, that's it. It's gone. Like you either heal or you die and that's it.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, the other key or signature element of these games is that if you can find your corpse without dying mm-hmm. twice in a row, you can recover the ground you lost, which I have to admit is like it's perfectly addicting. Mm-hmm. I totally get that element and why it feels so good. Like it did not work on me. I'm definitely tense every time I'm dead, but there's a chance I could win back 10,000 souls, but mm-hmm. I only have one hit left. Like I get it. It definitely provides an emotional roller coaster. I just don't know if that's what I... No, sure. I do. I enjoy it very much because roguelikes are sort of taking over the landscape lately, and I love a ton of them. I mean, we talked about Hades at the top. We're going to talk about Returnal on this show, on the next episode of this show. But at the same time, I just would have appreciated if the bar was just low enough for me to have seen the rest of the game. That's all. It felt like cordoned off. And Sekiro, I at least could complete. And I don't know why. I don't know what the difference was. But as hard as I try at this goddamn Bloodborne game, I cannot get the hang of it in the way that other technical genres I've eventually surmounted, like your Mortal Kombat's, you know, another genre where you do have to kind of know how many frames stuff, the duration, frame duration of moves and hitboxes and whatnot. I can get that in other games from you. This whole episode is me just being like, these games are so hard.
One thing about Bloodborne that is unique, even among From Software games, is the dodging forward component. Like
dodging through things is very satisfying.
It's very satisfying, and also like I think that like that one single move, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist elsewhere in From Software, but you rely on it a lot more in Bloodborne. Is sort of like anthemic to or thematic to like what makes Bloodborne different than other From Software games. Like the fact that you're encouraged to do a completely counterintuitive move that actually feels like you're taking a bigger risk and that is the path to success is sort of why Bloodborne stands out from, again, Demon's Souls, Dark Souls, Sekiro, right? And we talked about this, but I think that it takes a little, like, there's a sort of a chasm that you have to leap over, right? It's like a Kierkegaard work or something, right? Where you have to just take this blind leap of faith. And that blind leap of faith is the roll forward into an attack. Like, once you get into that rhythm and are willing to, like, no, I'm going to swing first, even though if I take this damage, I'll die. I'm going to swing first. And if I do that, it'll stop his attack motion. Like that kind of gameplay, which is like sort of being aggressive.
The stagger mechanics are very key to progressing. And I will say it is one of, there's only like two or three things, but there are, it's interesting that there are things that you can be told that are concrete. Like Zach referenced one earlier, when someone told me, the gun is not to deal a bunch of damage or avenge, you know, like in a traditional game where if you're holding a gun, you're supposed to kill most things with the gun. Someone was like, no. In Bloodborne, the gun is your counter. That's why it's in your left hand. I was like, oh, that is much more useful. Like now there's a rhythm I'm getting. And dodging forward is the other thing. It very much encourages you to go on the offense first.
Which, like, I think that for me was the thing that made Bloodborne the one From Software game that got me in.
Yeah. I like that about it.
Yeah, I mean, every boss fight basically is a like involves a roll into the attack mechanic. And the first time you do it, you feel the fear of your imminent death. And I really think like that sounds very dumb and obvious, but like I can't think of another game that does it. Can you?
I just did, as you mentioned it. I feel like it's almost a spiritual twin or just emotional sibling to the Doom Eternal experience, the game we covered last episode.
Which is taking from Bloodborne.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Exactly. Even though it's technically a completely different genre, right? It's got the steep difficulty curve and that feeling of the only way to win you realize is, oh, the loop actually wants me to. There's so many games where you duck and cover and try not to take damage as you chip away at the enemy. Doom is like, no, you'll die that way. You have to attack all the time and not care if you're taking damage because we'll constantly spit health at you if you play correctly. Mm-hmm. So that they have like the same revelation at their core. And I do like, I I do like being aggressive. Be aggressive. It is fun.
I mean, this game also has sort of very unique weapon animations. And I don't mean like animations it looks cool when you do it. I mean like most of your timing and the way you're going to play the game is based around how long does it take for you to execute an attack, and like are you going to execute like the jab or the heavy punch, that kind of, you know, duality.
Well, and also like how well do you chain together the attacks that you have at your disposal?
Yep.
Can you master the idea of like mixing a quick attack with a heavy attack with a trick weapon attack with a gunshot, you know, like how can you juggle the four or five limited attacks that you have into a chain of attacks to stagger and then, you know, inflict further damage? I think that like playing the game now, even though I've played it enough times and that I'm like okay at it, watching somebody play it that knows what they're doing and is actually good at it is like artwork.
Yep,
man,
like
it's
ballet.
Just incredible to watch somebody play this game that knows the game super well. It looks like ballet.
Yeah, it looks like a dance.
It's also very interesting, and I would say arcadey in some ways, how restrained the behavioral palette is. Like you mentioned Bayonetta and Devil May Cry, and a signature of those games, right, is that they keep your interest by constantly having, now when you press XX triangle, it does this thing that you never did before. It does the flip kick. Mm-hmm. Now you can do a flip kick and shoot, and your heel grows and stabs the guy in the dick or whatever. Like, you just keep adding different new stuff your character does. And I think it's very interesting how much restraint, Sekiro less so, but Bloodborne certainly has. Like, you're right, regardless of the weapon you choose, you only do so many things, and that's all you'll ever do. And it invites you to get very familiar with exactly how many frames of animation it takes to do those things.
I mean,
things.
It actually lays out most of the weapons that you can get pretty early.
Right.
For early, the purpose of you, like, getting good with it, figuring out how to use it, and then, like, walking through the rest of the game. Like, basically by about a third of the way through the game, you can afford / are using your favorite weapon for the rest of the game.
Rest of the game.
So like again, like that's another way, like this game is structured in a way that reinforces what is fun about it and what it needs you to do. Like, so it takes a little while to like settle into that. Like, it's very much a Zen rhythm thing. Like, it really is. If you can't like settle into that rhythm of I'm going to die a bunch of times, but when I win, I will have won forever and like enjoy that, you know, like that's the thing.
But have either of you ever had the experience? Okay, I've occasionally had the experience where in a game like that, the split second, has this ever happened to you? Like, you beat a boss that took 25 tries to beat, and the game fails at that split second, and you do have to do it again, and you just, it's one of the most demoralizing things I think you can experience in life.
That is horrible.
That's why, that's the Bloodstarved Beast, the tale of the Bloodstarved Beast is like three almost wins.
You crashed out?
Yeah, you know, and he poisoned me or some bullshit, and you're like, all right, man. I also, like, there's kind of a subtle, fun thing about this game, which is, there are a bunch of other hunters that you can find and combat. And I don't mean other hunters like necessarily like actual people, although you can summon actual people to help you with the boss, which is kind of fun. But there are other players that are exactly your type of character that you can find in the world. And if you can kill them, and they're the hardest battles, that's when you get like the really sweet loot. And most of the incredibly difficult stuff is actually optional. Now, I think that when you get really good at Bloodborne, you kind of don't care. It's like, I'm just going to clear this whole place out. But like, if you're the kind of person that's like, you know, I just want to see where it goes, you could miss, like, I think half the bosses, maybe more.
Yeah.
A lot, you know, like, so the game...
I mainly want to see the cool world. Well, not cool world, but Bloodborne's cool world. Can we talk a bit about like the look and feel and the artwork aspect of it? Because it succeeds on so many levels there that I am able to like appreciate and partake in. One is like they use cognitive dissonance in a way that reminds me of like German expressionist early days filmmaking, like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and shit. Like the, for example, the giant crows that like are not that tough of a boss or of an enemy. They, you know, like slop at you and shriek. The noise that they make doesn't sound like a crow. It sounds like someone recorded a crow through a speaker that they fucked up, or like kicked the speaker a bunch before they ran the sound through it, or they turned it up so high in audition or whatever that it's peaking. My point being that the sound design is artistic in nature rather than an impressionistic in nature and not realistic in nature. And that is like carry through. Like, I think Bloodborne has some of the most effective sound design in video games. And I think as a medium, video games, like, sound design is so key, especially for a feeling of dread or shock or terror. And goddamn, every monster in Bloodborne feels so handcrafted from an artistic perspective, that sound and feel and look, that it was like a delight to turn a corner and see a new, like, oh, a sewer pig. He looks so cool. And then, because it's not like, Mario, where you get 20 iterations of Goomba, 20 iterations of it. It's like a very weird, eclectic mix of, it reminds me of a kid who likes to draw in elementary school.
Right.
The real weird kid who doesn't have a story, but they just draw a bunch of monsters and they have like a few details in their mind about each monster. It's not cohesive. It doesn't hold together. But there's something about this weird kid's drawings that are very disturbing. And I actually think the artist or team of artists who have that unique From Software look are one of the more, like, that's one of the more unique vibes in all of media right now. It feels like it's in the horror genre, but not any specific horror. Like, it's its own thing. It doesn't feel like it's from The Conjuring, or it doesn't look like H.R. Giger or Giger or whatever. It really feels like its own very gross, decaying universe. And I mean that across games that are totally wildly different, right? Like, Bloodborne is, we hunt monsters and it's sort of faux European 1800s. And then Sekiro is like ninja in totally different milieu, but it still feels, all the creatures are like elongated in a weird way that is upsetting. And yeah, I just can't stress enough how much of a vibe all From Software games have.
Yeah, and I think the thing about Bloodborne in particular is that it was so different from what they were doing with Dark Souls, you know, previously.
Yeah.
Dark Souls was obviously very heavily influenced by fantasy works and really influenced by Berserk. I don't know if you're, you know, familiar with that manga and anime series, but like Miyazaki has said that he pulled a lot of influence from Berserk for the Dark Souls series. And Bloodborne is that, but different. You know, it is that same. The world of Dark Souls is set during an apocalypse. You know, the world is literally falling apart around the player character. And Bloodborne feels like the beginning of that sort of story, where you've got this blood virus that turns people into monsters. And so you've got this sort of Victorian city that is falling apart because everyone is too interested in just doing monster shit that, you know, to take care of the town around them. So you've got this like decaying idea of a city, and there are people hidden throughout the city that are, you know, they'll talk to you from behind closed doors and tell you, like, I'm not going out there, like, everybody's a beast now, it's fucked up. But the further that you get into the game, the weirder and weirder it gets. Like, I'll never forget the moment where your perception, your insight is high enough that you can see the giant Cthulhu creatures crawling across the Victorian, you know, Gothic churches in the background. And it's just like, what the hell is that doing there?
Yeah, that's dope. I didn't get that far.
Yeah, as you get deeper into the game, you know, you come you start fighting these like Cthulhu-type enemies, and you start seeing things like Rom, the vacuous spider, which is just this like giant blob of spider creatures. Like, it's fucked, and like all of the enemies are different enough, but still the same enough to be recognizable as like a From Software creation, but sets itself apart from the stuff that came before it and the stuff that came after it in Sekiro and games like that, Dark Souls 3.
Yeah, it has like a the closest thing, like the most analogous thing that I can experience or that I remember that it reminds me of is the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. like if the Haunted Mansion had more teeth, like it feels like yeah. that's kind of the vibe of this game. Also, that's kind of the fun of this game. You know what I mean? That's sort of like there's a little bit of a.
Oh, you mean because there's a bunch of spring-loaded animatronic scares in no. that exactly space correct. That you become familiar with?
I mean, okay. Yeah. You didn't get that yeah. far. You didn't consume enough insight to see the jangly face jump up from a tombstone. But no, it has like a... There's a kind of... I keep saying fun, and I don't know what better word there is to describe it, but like it doesn't feel like terrifying for its... Despite its artwork, it feels like... there's a sort of allure, like an invitation to it, you know, like it's sort of having a good time with you. Part of it is like you're constantly killing townspeople that look like sort of decaying Dickens characters, mm-hmm. you know, and like they also say
they
things.
They look lycanthropic to some degree.
Yeah. They're also saying things that are like it's very like murdering a werewolf English town, you know, after in the middle of some weird. Werewolf apocalypse, you know, and it's great. I think that the aesthetic sort of dances on the idea of getting into like grimy, gross, like evil
shit.
I was
going to say it feels
never gets
it
there.
It feels dirty and taboo and obscene to me, like intentionally. So
I think it's pretty. I think it's very careful about not going too far down that road. Like, it's not...
But do you know what I mean? Where there's some,
I do
like
know what
R,
you mean.
R. Crumb's art reminds me of this. R. Crumb could just draw a phone book, and you'd be like, that phone book looks dirty, though.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's something about the style of the art.
It does look like everybody in this town has leprosy or something. Like, there's all kinds of, like, bloody yeah. rags and shit. But it's not... there's so many horror games that have tried to capture this, and they always go too far... So that it actually feels like a grimy, sort of like nasty place. Bloodborne doesn't feel like that. Like Bloodborne feels like a really, like an oil painting in a fun, spooky house or something. You know,
right? And like your Resident Evil 4s and villages of the world have some lycanthropic medieval villagers wandering around. But something they all do is, I think, what most storytellers would do, which is try and tie it all up in a bow where they come up with some like Umbrella Corp did blah blah blah. And I understand that it's literally called Bloodborne and the Bloodborne virus is why people are turning, but there are so many elements of the quote-unquote story, such as it is, that are just left cryptic. Like,
right.
You're like, it's not like there is an Umbrella Corp that they're trying to weaponize some shit and that's why everything... No. They'll just be like... And I gotta say, on a textural level, I really appreciate the writing, actually, like the text in Bloodborne. It is very effective. It's not very information-laden, but it'll be like, you know, you'll get a thing and it'll be like, this bell is made from soap flakes from the bones of... the last knight who fell,
right.
You know, when the princess here like caused the great cataclysm.
This is the,
and you're like, all right, cool item.
This is the ultimate. This is the ultimate game to me for the difference between lore and narrative. This is the perfect mm-hmm. game to discuss this problem. So, or mm-hmm. this distinction, because
I don't think it's a problem in the sense that I think they didn't want it.
Oh
narrative.
No, I agree.
I think it's quite intentional.
If you, yeah. if you, as a consumer of this game. Are not willing to take the information that they provide to you and spend time outside the game or like time stopping, not playing the game, but considering all these pieces and like sort of maybe even assembling it on a spreadsheet or something, you will find a narrative here. Like I've seen people that did it. And I think that to me, that is antithetical to what a narrative experience is, which is the story informs my actions and I feel emotions about the story beats and about the actions I'm taking because of what they mean for the story. That is all completely gone in this game. Instead, there are pieces that are all very tantalizing and well-written in like, and interesting and like mysterious that don't add up to a whole in any consumable way. Unless you're willing to like write the story together for them, that is the difference
exactly.
between lore and narrative.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. It's like the majority of the characters that you come into contact with throughout the course of Bloodborne, you know, characters like Father Gascoigne or Vicar Amelia or Mikalash, you know, who led the scholars previously. Like, all these characters actually have a really rich backstory, and a lot of them are kind of dependent on these, like, half-cocked side quests to, you know, get to understand where these characters came from, what their deal was. But, like you're saying, you've got to put it together through item descriptions. You've got to put it together through dialogue that, in the moment, might not necessarily seem super relevant to the overall plot of the game, but when you piece it all together, you know, there's dozens of lore experts out there and on YouTube, and when you follow them down the rabbit hole and watch their explanations for games like Bloodborne and Dark Souls, all of a sudden it's like, wow, these stories actually whip ass.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
They're not told to you in a way that is like, and here is this person, and they like this thing, and this is where they came from. You know, like, it's not the traditional narrative that we're used to seeing in a video game. It's presented in a completely different way. One of my favorite YouTube series, previously Prepare to Try, now called Retry, from the RKG guys out of the UK, their lore expert, Daniel Krupa, is super well-versed in all Bloodborne and Dark Souls lore, and does a great job of trying to make sense of the backstory as, you know, his buddies are playing it along with him. It's a really interesting watch, I think.
Does so he never researches it. He just, like, tries to talk it through.
I'm sure that he's done, you know, copious amounts of research. I don't think you put a story like the stories being told in these games together without doing some research.
Right.
You
know? That's
somebody out there. Maybe Vati Vidya is the premier lore expert for these games, you know, but I think a lot of his work has spawned a lot of other people kind of, you know, their own interpretations or their own readings of the tea leaves, as it were.
It's interesting. Yeah, so, like, mm-hmm. Because Mike and I often do battle about whether a story is effective, mm-hmm. I like to make it clear when, like, everything you said is completely true in my experience too. Like, when I watched the 30-minute video, I was like, you know, a lot of this is really good. A lot of it's really good. There's a few things that are like, I don't understand that, but that's fine. But on a fundamental moment-by-moment experience level, nobody should play this game and expect to retain any sense of what happened here. Like, I don't think.
No.
Like, it's especially a bummer because the last fight in the game, spoilers, is against the guy who's been sort of training you the entire time to combat and overcome this, you know, apocalypse.
The guy, the dude in the wheelchair in the chapel?
Yes, he is the final boss.
Oh, he's the final boss?
And he's that's funny. He's fucking hard, by the way.
Technically, he's not the final boss.
Right.
If you go through and you
There's
collect all
thing.
The guts and all kinds of shit, yeah, you fight the
get
great
good,
one.
Adam.
No,
yeah,
I fought the other thing, too. Don't I? But, like, it felt very tacked on to this fight, honestly, like this fight with this guy.
The main thing was killing the old
well,
man.
Well, so, but again, it plays in this very dramatic way. You know what I mean? Like, everything about it from, like, you know, the house burns and you're, like, out there and, like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to fight him now, feels very dramatic. And I think it sort of tells you how talented this team really is, that it's still evocative even though it's completely contextless. You know what I mean? Like, you have mm-hmm. almost no context for what's happening. You're like, you don't understand why this guy is your enemy now and, like, why you have to kill him, but you still feel like, wow, like, it has an evocative feeling, which tells you how strong the mechanical work and the artistic work and the sound design are. Like, they're really good to make it basically a nonsense sequence into a
yep,
satisfying
that's what
battle.
I meant by cognitive dissonance. Yeah, they're not necessarily tied to the fabric of, like, logical cause
right.
and effect. It's I hate to make a reference that I make all too often, but there's too few directors working in this liminal space, but it's kind of
Lynchian. Yeah, David Lynch. Yep. That's
sure.
exactly who is good at it. Yep.
Even though it's like, man, he owns that reference. You know what I mean? Whenever something gives me that vibe, all I can think of is, this is Lynchian. I wonder
right.
when another filmmaker will rise also be in that
Terrence
space.
Terrence Malick also operates in this space, but not in a way that's like completely
where you have to fill in the dots.
Well,
there's just the suggestion of elements.
Yes, and also, like, he will use elements to let your brain supply the correct narrative beat that happened there, even though you're not really mm-hmm. getting it from the material. And I think that's happening a little bit in Bloodborne too, where it's like, why did I kill that scholar? Why did it matter when I killed that scholar over the sea that then led to me fighting that spider? I don't know. But like right. My brain kind of filled in the, like, this was a betrayal and like a turning point. Like, you fill it in.
Well, and also video games, as we've discussed ad nauseum, they're different in their nature in that a video game can also just be a toy. It doesn't have the same onus to have to be a story.
Right.
It's just, you like some internal consistency. So if you set out to be a story, then be a story. But if you are just trying to be an experience, that's totally valid in video game land, which is a cool thing about the medium. But it leads me to the question, like, do you think the From Software formula needs a story? In other words, y'all excited for Elden Ring?
Because yeah, so
just to catch the audience up, Elden Ring is the next one from this team, and it's being made in conjunction with George R.R. Martin of Game of Thrones fame. And one of the things that they're pushing or leading with is there will be a more recognizable story. Like they've said, we understand we've been cryptic. We like cryptic stories. This one will be a bit more like you could follow it because it's by George R.R. Martin.
Can I frankly say, I don't think George R.R. Martin is a guarantee that the story is going to cohere.
Right.
But let's say hypothetically that is their goal, is to present a more traditional story first From Software game. I almost wonder if that's necessarily something we even need in a From Software game.
I don't think we do.
I'll
just be brief. Like, I don't think we need it. I think From Software has earned the right to try literally anything they want, and I will play that game. Like, that's how good I think not only Bloodborne is, but their product is. They are really, they're the masters of this thing. So many video game franchises are stealing from this thing because of how good it is. Like, to me, it's like, if you want to try telling a story, let's see what that's like. Absolutely. You know, it didn't need it to buy the game. I'm still going to buy it because it'll be fun.
But you're like, it's your genre. Yeah, do whatever you want with it.
Yeah. You're Spielberg of this. So go ahead, man.
All right.
I think that Sekiro was kind of a step in this direction as well. Like Sekiro definitely has a more cohesive and more, it presents a clearer story. You know, I think that it's definitely less obtuse. And I wonder what George R.R. Martin's involvement is. You know, recently this news kind of blew up a few weeks ago. He was, you know, giving a local interview with a news station, was talking about how, oh yeah, you know, I finished work on this game years ago and I gave them the scenario for this thing. So I feel like he kind of just, you know, threw out a couple of bullet points and they're, you know, okay, this is what I think for this. You guys do your thing. And From Software will do that, you know? So when they say that it's like featuring a story by George R. R. Martin, I think it's a story in the way that he was like, okay, well, maybe the world is this and maybe the characters are this and maybe these are some of the things that occur. But, you know, I don't necessarily like, know that that
there's
means
a
that,
powerful ring. Like, right. There's already an epic fantasy. Right. And he's like, it doesn't
but
matter.
They all betray
this
each other.
Different
they
one.
Betray each other. There's a lot of betrayal.
There's a dragon.
I would say, like,
yeah. I don't know. Why is that our George R. R. Martin?
Because you're not too far off.
He has kind of a one of these kind of voice. he
well, there's a dragon.
Yeah, there's a dragon, and you have a wand, and you attack the dragon. Like, to me, George R. R. Martin may not have written anything in 8 years. It's completely possible he hasn't written a word.
You mean like he's renting his name out to shit?
Yeah, I think that's completely possible. I don't hate George R. R. Martin. I'm fine with him. I think that.
But do you hate story in a From game? That's more
how
relevant,
can
I would say.
How can I hate it? Like what? Like to me,
it's barely there to begin with.
Right.
Like, what,
I mean, like,
what's the hate?
If they start having stupid ass cutscenes instead of letting me kill
that's
monsters, then I might
that's
not like.
That's what
it.
I fear.
I'm not afraid.
Right.
Yeah. These guys have such a strong sense of like what they want to do mechanically, which I value. That like even a couple of cutscenes, it's like okay, I'll give it a shot. You know, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And even when Sekiro got into cutscene territory, I don't necessarily think it was particularly intrusive. You know, I think that they're pretty good about knowing when to, you know, when to hold them and when to fold them, as it were,
right.
When it comes to cutscening. And if there is a more, if there is a bigger emphasis on story in Elden Ring, I'm kind of here for it. Like, I would love to see them tell, you know, a bigger kind of sweeping fantasy story in their signature style. And maybe that's not necessarily the cryptic style of Bloodborne or Dark Souls, but something more right. akin to what they were experimenting with in Sekiro.
Well, all I can say is Sekiro, by adding a stealth like dimension to the game, allowed me to complete it. So I hope that they still keep that, but I doubt they will. It doesn't seem like
a stealth game.
I don't
game.
Know.
Yeah.
No, you're going back to being a knight in shining armor, Ooh. Which is less of a stealthy trope.
Like, to
so
be clear,
I think I might be fucked, gentlemen.
Maybe. To be clear, like, I do not anticipate Miyazaki, right? Isn't that the Miyazaki? Isn't that the
Miyazaki?
Yeah, Miyazaki.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Becoming a Kojima. Like, I'm not worried about that.
I was going to say, I played through every Metal Gear Solid, so obviously I can
right.
withstand
it's
a few cutscenes from
love,
From if
you
I
You love
need
the
to.
Death Stranding, and, like, to me, it's like this...
I do love the
Elden
Death
Ring
Stranding.
Has absolutely no chance of being the Death Stranding in terms of cutscenes. Just no chance
no.
of that.
Certainly
yeah.
not.
So I'm not really sweating yeah. it. Can I say one thing about the toxic culture? The get-good culture?
Sure.
I kind of don't think they're that... obnoxious as a gaming culture. Like, they're not Call of Duty bros. Like, I understand that it is condescending to tell that to people who are frustrated with the game. I completely get that, and I'm not saying it's not.
In your moment of
yeah,
frustration,
it's not nice.
Usually,
it's not
yeah.
nice. No, I mean, Twitter's not nice. Like, you know, I it's okay.
Yeah.
I think, though, that most of that rhetoric is actually true, which is something Zach was saying. Like, most of the time when they're saying get good, that is the only way. That's true. And also, I think there's kind of a fun, like, almost monastic vibe to this, like, whole...
See, I hate people like
yeah,
you.
Yeah, but, like, but they're right, though. You know what I mean? Like, it's like...
But you're flashing me back, too. So I have a friend, Griffin, who is good at everything
right,
somehow.
Right, right. And he's holding it over you.
I think the key is that he's just really good at focusing, not letting his emotions get involved, and focusing on tasks.
Sure.
But as a kid, it was always notable how he could pick anything up really quickly. So any video game we would play, you would beat him the first couple rounds, and then as if he were the T-1000 or something, he would just be like, oh, I understand this game now, and wreck shop and be unbeatable from that point forward. And I would, like, get, because, you know, I'm nine years old, I would get red-faced and, like, teary, frustrated, and literally be like, tell me, like, how you do. You have to explain to me. I beat you before. What am I doing? How is this happening? And he would always go, like, I don't know how to explain that I watch the computer
and
I do what I think I should do. Until it's right and it's better than what you did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Just
like,
learned.
You just have to be good yeah. at the process of the thing it wants
see,
you to do. And I'm like, well, make me good at it.
See, I think, though, that, like, a toxic... Because we have a lot of different spices of toxic game culture, let's be honest, right?
Yes.
So, like, this particular game culture, I haven't encountered many examples of them being like, oh, you're so bad, you suck, like, aggressive. I've encountered them being like the Ra's al Ghul of video games, where it's like, hey, man, like,
that's what I mean, is they just yeah, go, you must get good then.
Like,
you must get good.
And like, I kind of like that as like a companion culture to this game. I think that's kind of fucking awesome. You know what I mean? It's like, listen, all who have passed through the gate then learn the wisdom, you know, but you must pass through the gate. Like, I love that shit.
It's, I
know,
love it. But it is frustrating when you're like, but I did this and it still didn't work. And they're like, shh, shh, shh. Just
yeah,
get
pass,
good.
Pass
just
through the gate.
I mean, I also was like, I have also been repeatedly floored by my ability to just throw myself against a boss to the point that when I played Dark Souls, when I played Bloodborne, I had a chair, you know, a kind of swing back leather chair that I would position near the television so I could just whip my controller into it, you know, on frustration.
I love it.
I actually broke a controller playing Sekiro.
Wow.
Which is the only time I've ever done that. I was embarrassed to say it, but I spiked my controller on the ground so hard that it shattered. But I've also been continually impressed with my ability to, like, throw myself against a boss to the extent that I'm not frustrated and then quit and vow that I'm never going to play this fucking game again. and then come back the next morning and do it in like one or two attempts.
When you sleep on it, the neural pathways lock in. The muscle memory is much stronger the next morning.
But like, it's surprising to me, Mike, that this is like a, and I'm not trying to be a prick, I promise. It's surprising that this game.
You don't have to try.
It's just so good. Oh, it's so natural. But it's so like, that this game is like that kind of a barrier, because I've watched you in so many things in your life, like have that vexing moment and then like wake up and like write, like writing, you know what I mean? Where you're like, you, it's like a frustrating process and then you overcome and it feels great. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's a pleasure that you like as a person, you know what I mean? Like, I'm wondering if you can cause that's how I felt when I would like, I don't know, 8 months ago, I was like, this just isn't fun cause it's hard. But then when you, like, again, when you get it.
Oh God. I thought after we recorded this, I would be, the obligation to play Bloodborne would be finally off me. You're saying, are you trying to get me to play it again?
No, I'm just like counterpointing that. Like there is a possibility that like, that
one day I might still conquer that mountain and I would enjoy it.
And you might. Yeah. Like I found that very condescending until I beat Bloodborne. You know, like,
well, I'll tell you, the most recent attempt, it's almost like my Moby Dick in the sense that I've read the first third of it 4 or 5 times, you know, with months in between each attempt. But the most recent time, I actually didn't get stopped by a boss per se. I got stopped by a point where I couldn't figure out anywhere else to go on the map. Everything seemed like a dead end. And I refused to look it up. So maybe I'll try again someday.
I mean,
who knows?
Michael, just look it up, dude.
Yeah. You should cheat if you need to. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, you don't owe the
game
anything. But
then did you really get good? Yes. I have to prove everyone who ever said get good wrong. I have to go and show them I got good and then get their approval.
I also think,
I think there's a distinct difference in like looking up where to go next versus, you know, the getting good that you're talking about, because you're still gonna have to fight all those monsters whenever you figure out where to go. You're just stuck, you know, trying to figure out what's next.
I think this is an increasingly obsolete way to game, but I do not look up guides, FAQs, or YouTube videos or anything. I don't cheat.
I think games are now at a point where they expect you to utilize a community. Bloodborne is definitely at that point because they incorporate that feature into the game itself.
Oh yeah, I don't think I would have finished.
Oh, you
this
can
game.
Leave messages for each other. Yeah,
I don't think I would have finished this game the first time if I hadn't been able to call somebody in to help me fight the final bosses, the final two bosses. I summoned a buddy of mine who'd already beat the game a couple of times. You know, like it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the absolutely. Game wants you to do that if you're not enjoying it. Like that's the thing is like. It seems like a sadistic game at times, but then you realize like, well, they've built these things into it that you feel are like lame, but they're not lame. They gave you this opportunity, and like, there's a lot of games, like for instance, Destiny, a game I love to come back to, that are increasingly built around the idea like somebody's going to figure out the binary code solution to this gun, and once they do, you'll get the gun, you know. But
that is an exception. I would never play a Destiny raid without just looking up how to do it. That seems
nuts. You wouldn't be able to.
I would not grind through figuring it out.
You wouldn't be able to, because if you went with a random raid group, they'd be like, you don't know, get the fuck out. Right. Now that, by the way, is toxic culture.
Right.
Bloodborne expects you to like look up a guide if you need to, summon a friend if you need to, take a break if you need to. You know what I mean? Like, I think it really, they want you to do that. You should do that.
That's why it doesn't work for me. Bloodborne requires emotional maturity, which I don't have.
There it is.
Yes, so it's not.
It actually rewards you for just being like, maybe I'll set it down for a few hours. I can't do
maybe
that.
Maybe you should try streaming it. I know that sounds like counterintuitive, but go with me. It's the roll forward of video game playing moves. Stream it so that you only have to play 2-hour intervals.
I streamed the Father Gascoigne fight, and it was very exciting to have
everyone.
They'll
cheer for you.
Everyone's happy when you finally get it.
And people will throw out suggestions. People will tell you what you're doing wrong if you want them to. You know, Jonathan Dornbush at IGN has built a real community in his streams by originally playing through the From Software games, and a lot of that was, you know, based around the idea of like, oh, these guys are giving me tips as I'm playing, and we're all celebrating these successes and lamenting the failures and together. You know, I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I'll
play Bloodborne.
Just stream it. Just do an hour. Like, you know, like once a week, we're going to stream 2 hours of Bloodborne. If you really want to, if this appeals to you, if it doesn't, then, you know, fuck it. Like, if, like, you couldn't make me play more Death Stranding, you know what I mean? Like, so if it's dead to you,
same,
then I get it.
Yeah.
Wow.
I get it.
That's such a heavy statement to me.
I'll make you a deal. I'll make you a deal, Slim. You play through Bloodborne and I'll play through Death Stranding.
Boom. Yeah, the PS5, the upgrade.
That's right. Which, by the way, I know this is probably cliche, but like a director's cut of that game in particular,
yes,
a director's cut of who was cutting stuff from that director's vision, by the
even
way.
Even I don't need a director's cut. Yeah, the considering that, right, there's no, it was an independent Hideo Kojima production. What does that mean?
Right.
Stuff that he thought wasn't good enough to be in it, but now he does think it's good enough.
Who's cutting Tarantino's films down? That's the same person that cut Death Stranding down.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I'd like to see the Tarantino cut of Death Stranding.
Oh my God. Well, actually, I'm not opposed to that either. Yeah.
No.
Can I just, by the way, just one last word on those ravens? Those ravens can fuck you up. I don't like. I'm not embarrassed to say. Like, I've died to a raven by getting too close to it, like 100 times.
Yep.
Oh, I never had a lot.
Man,
of trouble
they'll fuck
with the
you
ravens
up. You get too close, they'll like. Reason. And also, they kind of sound like dog barks. You know.
That's what I mean. Is they don't sound like ravens. They sound like an artistic choice. That's what I love about it. They're like, they make this monster noise, and it's just, it's not really a noise you can place as an organic noise.
They look like a
noise.
Bird puddle. Like they look like a puddle of a creature, you know?
Yeah, everything in this game is wet and soggy and
oily.
Like, it's disgusting. Yeah.
And bespoke, like crafted with a lot of care.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you wear any crazy outfits? Did you get to, like, you know, what outfit did you settle on?
I don't know that I wore any particular, like, I feel like the outfits that you can get all somehow kind of mesh with each other, you know? Like, there's a lot of wacky shit that you can get, but somehow it all sort of works in the aesthetic. I did, some of the costumes from the Old Hunters DLC are pretty wild, and I really do love some of those guys. I've played through some of that stuff, for sure.
Once I got the crow-themed outfit, I determined I didn't care how many other pieces of clothing I was going to wear that for the rest of my life in that game.
Oh yeah.
So like a feathered shawl.
Yeah, it looks
or
so
what?
Yeah, you just look like a medieval doctor mixed with like a terrifying Valkyrie made of crow feathers. It's great.
Okay.
It's really good.
Well,
we might have done it.
I think it's final checkpoint time.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid back appeal and down home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
What's another? Let's see.
Back to the dream.
Campfire? Campfires are Dark Souls.
No, the lanterns. Mm-hmm. We have to light a lantern.
The lanterns.
They're lanterns. I was mixing them up with the campfires. That's right. We light our final lantern as Mike's brain fails to recover the pertinent detail and pass our last checkpoint. And that brings us to our final segment here on One Upsmanship called Keeper Delete. And I think we already know which way Zach's going to go, but this is where we decide if there were a celestial hard drive that aliens and or godly beings were going to judge humanity by that could only fit, let's say, 150 to 200 games. What are the odds Bloodborne would make it on that hard drive? Keep or delete, Zach, what say ye?
Oh, big time keep. Yeah.
It's a keeper.
Oh, yeah. I like I said at the top, this sounds like hyperbole, but I really think this is one of the best games ever made. I think that even going back and playing it last year, going back and playing a game like The Witcher, or Metal Gear Solid 5, yep. You know, like those feel of 2015. Going back and playing Bloodborne, like they could put that game out right now and it would still feel every bit as smooth and engaging and dynamic as it did the day that it was released. So yeah, I say definitely keep.
Adam,
what about you, Mike? Or do you want to go last? Do you want to go last? You can go last because you're the one that's not.
Is it a keep, clean sweep? I thought since I was the most on the fence, it would be more dramatic.
I'll go
if
second.
I went last.
Absolutely keep this game. I would love to see Sony put out a 60 frames a second 4K version of this game, like clean it up a little bit and re-release it. Mm-hmm. I think this is the best game on the PS4. It could be. And I can't encourage any of you enough who are like the game but frustrated with it. Like, put it down if you need to, but also like don't feel like you need to beat it. It's really fun when you get to a place where you're just enjoying the process and kind of just slowly making your way through it. It's very satisfying. 3 years ago, I tried this game like 10 different times and I was very angry with it. So like, I'm hoping some of you might have that experience. That would be a very rewarding game for you.
And you don't count that against it?
No, because I think this is the rare.
If I encountered a box in the desert and it made me angry over and over, but one time it made me happy, I would be like, that's a pretty mediocre box.
I think that From Software kind of has clearly laid out what kind of experience to expect from it.
They want you to get angry.
Well, I don't think you have to get angry. I think that's a chosen response. Like you could, it's normal to get frustrated. That's why I think to really enjoy it, you have to put down some expectations, and that's fun. Like that's a fun experience. And they just have this key to a different kind of video game fun experience that most games you play will not give you. And it's not like Battletoads hard where it's like, oh, this is just shitty level design, so you have to overcome it. It's like, a designed fun experience that works if you play it the way you're supposed to. Which to me suggests like not bad design, but perfect design. Right? That's why I think it's not a ding against it.
Yeah, I'm keeping it.
Whoa.
I can't delete Jazz. Then I wouldn't be smart and sophisticated.
I thought you might keep Sekiro or something.
Well, I don't know that we'll cover Sekiro. I do think of all the From Software games, Bloodborne is the most elegant and perfect in its systems design. Even though I can't beat it, I got far enough to appreciate that for the reasons we discussed, the roll forward, the aggression being the signature like feel of the loop. I do think it's probably objectively the best one, even though it's not the one that resonated with me. So. And I'm betting it's probably going to stand the test of time and still will have defenders even after Elden Ring. Or, people who think it's the best one. Mm-hmm. I think Bloodborne is super seminal and deserves to be kept.
Yeah, right on.
So there you go.
That's great.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Sweet.
And did we... I think we all deleted Doom Eternal. That feels
weird.
Yeah,
we did. But I don't... I mean, that's not a consequential game like this is.
I, I would probably keep Doom 2016 and delete Doom Eternal.
Boy, everybody but me. That's what everybody but me feels like that. Yeah. I feel like Doom Eternal is better, but that was a whole other conversation.
Sure.
People love Doom 2016.
I will, since we're talking about that Bloodborne feeling, though, Adam, I did just replay that part where you kill the tank and then you get catapulted to an area with two tanks. That is a fun moment. That's a fun moment.
The best moment in a Doom game to me.
You laugh and go,
you son of a
you.
Bitch. Yeah, the metal just hits again. You're like, oh my God. It's great.
And the guy goes, we're not done yet, Slayer. You're like, God damn it.
Anytime I get a feeling of a wink from a designer, like, I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, video games are so much more complex and multifaceted than films are, that it's harder to get the feeling that, like, a brain knew what your brain was going to think and was ahead of you. So that's what I loved about that. It was like, oh, okay, the people who designed this knew what I thought and were like, nah, here you go, motherfucker. Yeah. I loved it.
For sure. Hey, Zacharias, if people want to wink at you digitally, where could they find you on the internet?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at ZachariasD. You can follow me there. It's mostly goofs and guffaws and occasionally video game hot takes. But I try to keep it light, so...
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
That's mostly how we keep it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks again for hanging out with us, dude.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me
on. Yeah, it's great having you, man.
Yeah.
Right on, guys.
Adam, you got anything? I did the intro, so can you say something profound to wrap us out of here?
I can't say anything more profound than, like, embrace the Zen of the Blood Moon and, find your way back to the dream. Where all your pain will one day finally subside. Farewell, dear hunters.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Work complete.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.